Yeah. Have you read Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood?
I'm pretty sure I have. Yeah, it was quite a long time ago.
It's a fascinating, you know, she's her whole thing is that I think she was Catholic, right? Or Protestant, a Catholic. You know, and her whole thing is that her writing was, you know, God speaking through her, and you know, her writing's quite weird, you know. So it's one of the that's attractive to me, you know. But the main character in that, Hazel Motes, he comes back from I think World War One or Two, and he's starting his own church, which is the Church of Christ without Christ, you know. So he's building a religion out of atheism, you know. He denies the existence of God. Jesus is a trick. You know, it's don't protest too much, you know. He's going to these extreme lengths to convince others that God doesn't exist. And yeah, you know, in the end, the snake ends up eating its tail. And he actually, by murdering his physical double, so a symbolic image, commits the kind of sin that he then has to pay for the rest of his life. And so it's a real dark book, you know.
He blinds himself, doesn't
Yeah. Well, so that's like the ultimate negative identity complex, right? Like the Hazel Motes story. I mean, he's trying so hard to be the thing, to not be the thing that he hates, that he be, really becomes it. I mean, you know, that's all. You know, becoming your shadow.
Well, I know two people, and you probably guess who one of them is was, who said to me, "Even if God exists, I don't believe in him."
I have a feeling one's your brother.
And the other one was Phil Snyder, who was like a brother. I mean, my relationship with him was very brotherly. He's about the same age as my brother as well. Also an Aries, as in as well as me. And I was once trying to write a book together with him using his emails. That was how Answer to Lucifer began. It's this dialogue with him, and it included that quote in it, or that whole email maybe, where he said that, "Even if God exists, I don't believe in him." Which of course is changing the meaning of the word believe, right? Because if you know God exists and you don't believe in him, you're not saying you don't believe God exists, because you know it. You're saying, "I don't believe in him as a God or as a higher power."
Oh, I didn't even interpret it that deeply. I was thinking, oh, that's like, you know, because people are constantly accusing Christians of ignorance. It would be the opposite kind of ignorance, like, no, I don't want to know. La la la, 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 la. You know, if God exists, I don't want to hear. I don't want to know. So.
There is that too. But I saw it, and I think I'm sure I'm right, as a cry of defiance.
Right. Defiance. So even if there is a God, I'm not going to. Well, so that would mean like, I mean, it's almost more like, so belief would be like, so refusing to like worship God. So,
Or acknowledge his
yeah.
divinity. What would you say are some of the primary arguments against God that atheists make?
Are we talking about intelligent atheists like Sam Harris, or are we talking about my drinking buddies?
I don't know which end of the spectrum do you want to start at?
Guess it's better to start low,
Okay.
right? Oh, well, I mean, the first one that you hear is if God exists, why can't I see him?
Okay. Moving on then.
Oh, God. Wow. What else? Why does, if God exists, why does God need man's faith? If he's a supreme being, why is it so important to him that humans have faith in him? Or why is he a jealous God? This idea of the jealous God, you know, that sort of thing. Why is he so insecure? You know, I guess that's not really an argument against God. It's just sort of a, if this is how it is, then, you know, it doesn't make sense, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, of course, there are lots of arguments against that, but there's even one that I think is particularly interesting, which is relatively new to me, although in certain ways not, which is that, as described in the Old Testament, God, Yahweh, is one among gods. But he is the most high God. So there are these other gods called the Elohim, and they work for God. So when God says, I am the only God, there are no others besides me, he is acknowledging there are other gods, but that none are equal to him, and that's very important to be aware of, because otherwise you could end up, you know, worshipping a lesser god, and even demons and whatnot. So I think that argument can be demolished fairly quickly, just referring to scripture. And it's probably another example of how atheists or agnostics project onto an idea of God, you know, a lot of assumptions. Even like, why does God need worshipping? That's an assumption, right? That he needs it. There's a big assumption in there.
Is there a word for you know, we have the word anthropomorphize. Is there a word for projecting human qualities onto God? Yeah.
Well, isn't that the same? That is anthropomorphizing.
Is it because, well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not clear on the di dictionary definition of the word, whether that has to be an animal. You know, I don't know. Like if you can project human
No,
qualities.
I'm pretty sure it could be anything.
Really?
Yeah. So what about the other end of the spectrum? What sort of arguments does Sam Harris make?
Oh, Jesus. I don't know. It'd almost be better to look to, I mean, yeah, okay. Sam Harris is a good example. He's sort of the modern, he's the secular, the secular left. They have all these figures like Neil deGrasse Tyson who like Neil deGrasse Tyson, I don't even understand. Does he have like a real job, or does he is his job just going on Twitter and debunking Avengers movies? And you know, I can never really understand what it is he does, you know, and shitting on religious people, but I think specifically Christians, you know, like, that's the other thing I've noticed is a pretty broad, is a pretty, the trend is like, you know, if you talk to at least American atheists, you know, their negative identity complex, they're reacting to either their Christian upbringing or the predominant Christian culture in America, which who can blame them? But, you know, like you'll notice that if you bring Islam or Judaism into it, it's not quite as venomous.
Right. They're not as easy targets or eligible targets anyway.
Well, probably for one thing, most people don't know as much about, you know.
Yeah.
They haven't been exposed to those religions as much.
They're not fair game, though. Like, Christians is probably the most fair game now, except for white males.
Yeah, they're the fair game because they're the enemy, they're the Trump voters, they're, you know, it's
I think they were the Obama voters too, so I'm not really sure that that's a very valid accusation that they voted for Trump.
You're saying Christians voted for Obama?
Well, maybe less because he was half black, but certainly W and Reagan, and who's considered the greatest president in American history at this point.
Right.
You know? So anyway, Sam Harris.
Sam Harris. Yeah, I mean, I've listened to his podcast a couple of times, but well, we could Google it.
No, don't Google it. I just wanted to get you to see if you'd come up with something. As far as I know, the most common argument against the existence of God is why is there so much suffering in the world?
Hmm. Why does he allow so much suffering?
Yeah. No, that probably wouldn't be Sam Harris's, but there'd probably be some more sophisticated equivalent of that. And certainly Sam Harris's main argument against religion seems to be that it just fuels suffering and intolerance, and basically it's not politically correct. You know, it's not evolutionarily advancing religion, whatever. But I mean, I had a reason why I wanted to bring this up now, but it's been so long now, I'm not sure I can remember it. But it was something to do with the sort of the inseparability between human misery and anguish and awareness of God and the divine, like the two things, like the light and the dark, they seem to be mutually dependent, interdependent.
Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe I'm moving toward that. It's like this stuff that I sent you about deep fake. Like, maybe I'm part of what's happening as the world descends into more unreality, even though it's going to be harder to discern the real from the unreal in the kind of traditional sense of everything. It's like, even though that's going to be harder to discern, it's also going to free me up to see it all as kind of fake and let it go. And then, you know, well, I don't know what the end of that story looks like. I mean, it's tempting to get romantic and, yeah, I'm in a cabin in the woods picking carrots and carrying water, but, you know, you get the first part of the, you know, maybe part of it. It's actually God, I was thinking about that when I sent you that deep fake video, and there was something that William Gibson tweeted where he said, if so-called deep fake video technology becomes ubiquitous, wouldn't any ostensible porn tape be immediately suspect, thereby negating the impact of literally any porn tape, even genuine ones?
They mean that people wouldn't get turned on by it if they thought it might be fake.
Well, there's a million places you could go with that statement, right? Because, well, on the one hand, it's almost like looking on the bright side, because I could be saying that this is the end of scandal, right? Because all scandals would be suspect. But it could also mean that, like, I mean, it's too complicated to try and figure out, like, navigating, like, the collective shared world and the with all its politics and everything. But I guess just to bring it back into the personal, it's like maybe there's this thing of, oh, this is to free us up from our media dependencies and things like that.
Why would it though? Because people have things that if the fake, the deep, the fake is getting deeper, so that the real is more and more being replaced by the fake. That's only happening because we're losing the ability to tell the difference between the real and the fake, and the result of that would be that people don't care because the fake thing offers the same as the real.
Right.
I mean, that's my pessimistic perspective, of course. I mean, you and I don't feel that way, so it might be wrong to assume that billions of other people do if it weren't for the evidence that apparently they do. I mean, Game of Thrones, say, fake dragons, worse and worse script and acting, people are still hooked. That's always my go-to example. Because I like it, a subtler example of the fake replacing the real is, seriously and passionately created culture versus cynically manufactured. That's a sort of subtler spectrum between real and fake. And if people accept the cynically manufactured imitation of the previously creatively impassioned version without even noticing. I'd say they're being acclimatized or desensitized while at the same time being addicted, right? So people are addicted to porn. I don't see why they would care if they don't know whether it's real or not, as long as they.
Well, the fourth most searched for porn term is hentai, which is animated porn. So,
Right.
people have already been watching fake porn for quite a while now.
See, the upside is that I see, and because I used to like, there's a Spanish magazine that was porn, really, soft porn sometimes, not so soft. But anyway, it was comic book, and I used to feel that that's harmless porn because it's not exploiting real human beings.
Oh,
Just what?
that is the bright side. Keep
Yeah,
going.
one artist's imagination. So yeah, if more and more the porn's being replaced by CGI fake, then it's basically not porn. It's not dependent on human beings doing, things they don't really want to do and having to pretend that they want to do them.
Having to exploit others and
Yeah, and so it's essentially not debasing the sexual act in the same way
this
at
is
all.
great. This is where your benevolent force is surfacing. Look at
Yeah.
us looking at the bright side here.
Well, and I think I think we could extend this, like I see a new model emerging, to the whole deep fake, which is that if we're creating over time via the technology and everything, a fake version of human experience and existence, that's going to attract and addict and maintain the interest of people who are more and more oriented towards the fake. But
Fake
that
people.
fake people, exactly. So it will be the fake people who get sucked into the deep fake, and they won't exist. The deep fake doesn't exist. They won't exist. They will all just, be washed away with the coming judgment day. Ding, 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 ding. Sorry, you fell for a fake, so you're a fake. So in fact, you never actually existed, and no tears need to be shed.
I gotta tell you a quick anecdote and then we'll get back to the deep fake. But when I was an adolescent, when I was first beginning to masturbate, I didn't have the internet, of course. This was before the internet, and my dad did not have pornography magazines. Like a lot of, I feel like a lot of kids' dads had pornography, they can do that. And so I would draw what I imagined a naked woman to look like, based on the little glimpses that I'd gotten here and there. I would draw them, and then of course after the act, I would tear them into very small pieces.
The shame descends. And then later you think, why didn't I save those drawings? Now I've got
Yeah,
to
that
do it
was a
all
good
over
drawing.
again.
Now I've got to do it all over again. So it's like this whole lengthy process of imagination, creativity, and very healthy. I'm glad I didn't internet. I'm glad I didn't grow up with internet porn.
Me too.
But the deep fake, back to the deep fake, the bright side.
Back to Big Mother as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I guess I was almost there for a minute, like taking a very the kind of nature versus culture kind of ultimate, like it's a very hard line kind of, well, if all of culture is gonna be fake, which it is already, but if it's gonna be blatantly fake, where that it's all we don't even know what real culture is, real fake culture is. And the only real thing is, your hands in the soil,
I thought you were going to say your hands on your dick for a minute. I think that's fair.
So, it's like Plato's distrust of culture, like that might be where things, that's where I'm tempted to end up with this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it may, I say it may be fair because that may be where we are going collectively. Like the world made by hand may be the only future that there is.
Right. And it might be good for me to personally get a jump head start on that, like, so that's not an easy life, like when we go camping, that's suddenly tested, and can you do it? And that's just a baby, that's just a little taste of it too.
Yeah, I think the danger in that is one can become a dry drunk. Like one can, if one is doing it externally, although I do think there's merit in it as well, because there's merit if you're drunk, you've got to stop drinking, but not to mistake the not drinking to actually being free from the addiction
I'm
and
cured.
because it can actually reinforce the pattern. The denial can reinforce the pattern. So I'm personally more interested in dissolving those internal reliances on the carrots, the cybernetic carrots, than I am actually depriving myself of cybernetic carrots. And I do think I can notice. Of course, the retreats in Finland are very good for that. 7 days away from everything, including technology. And what I've noticed is progressively, I'm less and less bothered by it. And this last time, didn't notice it even. And for the first time, I wasn't looking forward to getting back to, you know, my computer or my life, or my wife, my cat, of course. But in terms of actually, oh, I've got a life that's I've put on hold, and it's exciting to go back to. I didn't hardly have that this time. It felt theoretically possible I could have just stayed there indefinitely. Now, of course, that is a kind of paradisical setup, so it's hardly the equivalent of what it would be like to live off the grid. I'm not going to claim that, but in terms of actually having reduced the points of identification within myself with the culture, the fake culture, I'd say that I've come quite a long way in that regard. You know, like, how much does our sense of existing depend on culture?
Right.
But that's the big question, and that's where people get lured into the deep fake and how they become fake, isn't it? Is that they become more and more identified with media, culture, cultural artifacts and media. And so they become less and less real, and so the culture becomes less and less real, and so it snowballs like that. And I've seen Big Mother comes in because, well, with porn certainly, and your drawings, that we're okay, so the ego gets created traumatically through attachment disorder relating to the mother and the father, but primarily the mother, and that involves the creation, the internalized image of the body, which is the healthy ego. And this first time I've said this or thought it exactly, but is spliced unnaturally with an internalized image of the mother's body, because we didn't separate it from it in a healthy way. So we had to keep imagining the mother's body to comfort ourselves as the ego was forming. So our internal image of ourselves, which is maybe a necessary temporary ego, is spliced with an internalized image of the mother's body. So we're like Brundlefly. We're half, our ego is half us and half the mother. And because of that, the ego can never dissolve, because it was never fully formed in the first place. And so we stay stuck in that developmental stage, the mirror stage, in the Lacanian thing. And so then the culture is like you and your drawings. We're constantly trying to recreate an image of the mother's body to masturbate over.
Right. Recreating, right.
Because you said, didn't you, you had to draw on what you could remember or imagine
yeah,
about
my
the mother's
glimpses.
Body. Yeah.
I didn't say my mother specifically.
No, you didn't. But she would have been the first body you ever saw.
That's true, and I do think that that's where I get this aversion that I have. That, and we talked about it, but it's actually very rare that men have a problem with this. But this whole shaved pubic hair epidemic—I'll call it an epidemic—is our culture is going through this barely legal pedo porn culture that nobody seems to even care about, but. Anyway, when I was a kid, yes, adult women had pubic hair. My mom had pubic hair, and children did not. And now I'm an adult, and I can't. It's dissonance. It's hard for me. I can't understand it.
Well, I've said it doesn't really encroach upon my experience, except when I hear about it from you or my sister. I wouldn't even know about it otherwise. But I certainly wouldn't have had any direct. I haven't had any direct experience of it.
It's like when you see like a Renaissance painting or something, you know, the way the ideal woman, the goddess looked in that era. And then you look at the anorexic little girl with the shaved crotch now, and you're just like, ah, what's happening to us? But I wanted to share a detail. This is a tasty detail that should probably end up in your book. It could be in both our books, but it seems more suited to your book. But something I realized. So with the AI or with the deep fake, there is, you know, constantly these efforts being made. The anxiety about it affecting the political situation seems to be growing. We seem to be knowing that this is going to play a big part in the next election year. And so there are these various attempts to detect the deep fake, and some of it has to do with programs that can recognize the signs, the, you know, the program. It's like reverse engineering the program that made the deep fake and all this shit. But the other thing is that somebody was saying that one way that often gives away the deep fake, because you saw the videos, it's getting pretty impressive, right?
I didn't watch that video you sent, actually, I didn't get to it.
It's getting pretty impressive. But one way that they've noticed in this stage of where the deep fake's at is that the deep fake character with the superimposed face or whatever doesn't blink as much as it should.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, wow. Because I remember remember an interview with Hannibal Lecter, Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that when he played Hannibal Lecter, the key was to not blink.
Mm.
You know, it's like it's something that he realized that psychopaths, sociopaths, they don't blink as much as they should. And I thought, wow, what a perfect, you know, the sociopathic culture. I mean, it would tie in, it would work well if you were, particularly if you were going to kind of, you know, paint transhumanism in a kind of, you know, Luciferian light.
Mm-hmm.
But the deep fake doesn't blink.
Yeah, and the reptilians.
Right. Right.
Because that, I thought that's where you were going to go, like those videos online of this politician's a reptilian, look, he doesn't blink.
Right, right. Well, that's, and then the sociopath, that's what we associate, right, with the psychopathic brain is the lizard brain, the reptilian brain.
Yeah.
So they would have been there all along, right? It's like,
as far as I know, lizards do blink, though.
Right.
Maybe not often, though. I think they blink very slowly, don't they, generally?
Yeah, it probably depends on what mode they're in.
But, maybe they consciously blink. Maybe the sociopaths choose to blink.
Well, very shortly, the AI, the deepfake program will, you know, compensate for that.
I was going to say, that doesn't seem like that would be a big obstacle, does it? Because, well, yeah, I'm surprised it even is. That means they must be automatically generated to some extent.
I'm sure by next year we'll have that problem solved, you know. But it's an interesting, right? It's a good.
Well, they might even have it solved already, but they're throwing it out there to throw us off, right?
Mm.
If we see somebody blinking, we'll believe it's not fake.
And you know what? It's interesting because you probably haven't seen this, but there's a big hubbub about O.J. Simpson being on Twitter. He just got on Twitter and he posted a video, and I watched his video and I'm thinking, this has to be a deep fake. Like, you know, there was something just slightly uncanny enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the strangeness of O.J. Simpson, you know, posting a video online. But I forget what he says. I mean, like, he says something cryptic at the end. He's like, I'm looking forward to sharing stuff with my people, and I've got a lot of I got a lot of getting even to do. He said that, you know, something cryptic like that.
Is he out then? He's out of jail.
Yeah.
All right, because I saw his face on the tabloids, and so I didn't even really think about it. I just wondered why he was on the tabloids. So that came right after the American Crime Show. I mean, pretty close, a couple of years later, which made it pretty clear that he was guilty, or, you know, certainly reinforced the idea that he's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Who's he want to get even with? Because he's saying he's framed, I guess.
I'm sure he has all sorts of enemies, right? Like the sheer amount of people who've called him guilty, and never mind, people he probably perceives as having betrayed him. I mean, that's why he did go to jail, is because he couldn't control his violent temper and was coming to get some piece of property back, or some football memorabilia back from somebody at gunpoint. So anyway, but I watched the video a second time because it was so uncanny, and he only blinked once. But then, it occurred to me, this is an interesting question, because what do you do when it's a deep fake of a sociopath? Because he could be, O.J. Simpson could be a sociopath. So it's like the deep fake will be a lot more convincing when it's of sociopaths, which a lot of politicians are. So we're already in trouble, right?
Well, I would think anyone's in trouble who's paying attention to the news in such a way as they think that it's going to help them live their lives.
Yeah, to navigate reality via...
But I'd say that's been true for decades. I don't think that's particularly pertinent to the deep fake. I suppose the deep fake is an example of something becoming overt that was always implicit, isn't it?
That's what I mean. Maybe this overtness will somehow be freeing, because then you can just let go of that as a map. Yeah. If the map's not reliable at all, you can just let it go,
Right. Yeah, I think so. And I think we want it to be timed. I mean, hopefully it is being timed in our own lives with an orientation towards what is real, that isn't of this world, apparently. I mean, say that lightly, or that's easy to say as a platitude, but I'd say it's more and more experiential to me that there's something that isn't of this world that is accessible, and that is what's of true value. And obviously, needless to say, that makes it a lot easier to let go of the other stuff. In fact, I'd say that's the only way to let go of it. You can't turn away from culture if there isn't anything else besides nature, I don't think, because nature is terrifying.
Right.
It's so uninviting.
Right.
It's beautiful if you've still got culture as a womb. If you're just peeking out the womb of culture at nature, camping in the forest for 2 days, it's beautiful. But if you were just thrown back into it and survive, then it would be paralyzing. Just brought to mind that Anthony Hopkins line in The Edge, that people who get stranded in the wilderness die of shame. Did you see that movie, David Mamet?
No.
Quite a good movie. It's a sort of mixture of existential Mamet philosophy with Hollywood hokum, which is kind of a good mix. Anyway, that's his point, is that it's not their inability to survive that kills them directly, it's their recognition of how inadequate they are that paralyzes them, and then they give up because they're so ashamed.
And would it also be like too much pride to like return to civilization?
Well, I don't think he was talking about people who had a choice. I think he was talking about people who were stranded. They didn't have a choice, but they might be too proud to knuckle down and just deal with the reality. Imagine, they just sulk and starve to death because it was so challenging.
Right. Jesus. It's grim.
And it's just so much work. It would be just so much work to survive in the wilderness. Or even on a farm. But I would think that one's inner life would I mean, depending how bad it was. If it was really bad, you'd just be constantly efforting and you wouldn't be able to relax and be stressful and all the rest of it. But assuming it wasn't too grueling, but it did mean kind of working 8 hour days, manual labor, that's not too grueling, I'm saying, relative to what it could be. Then, like you and your shampoo factory, you might actually find that it freed up a lot of internal reflection. But it would be more so because you'd actually be learning about the natural environment and harmonizing, synchronizing with it.